Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what's a podcast?
A podcast is a thing humans invented to procrastinate from doing important things, like actual work or spending time with their families.
Neat. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're talking about Chapter 22, Season 2, Episode 8, Leap to Faith, directed by Linda Mendoza, written by Christopher Ensel, including guest cast Tia Sirkar, Jason Mendoukas, Mary Beth Monroe, Steve Berg, Amy Okuda, and Joe Mandy. A surprise visit from Sean shakes up Michael's plans. He tells Michael that his torture numbers are so good that they're both getting promotions, and they're going to franchise his whole torture model after dissecting the humans. Michael pretends to reveal the bad place secret to the humans, and they pretend to be surprised. The humans are not sure if Michael is turning on them due to his change in fortune, especially when Michael gives vicious roasts of them at the neighborhood destruction party. Eleanor, inspired by Michael's very human moment last episode, figures out that Michael is sending them coded messages. She convinces everyone to follow the instructions in his clues by reviving Derek and sending him with a decoy train to the medium place and hiding underneath it. Michael frames Vicky so Sean cocoons her and has Bad Janet scan the neighborhood for signs of the humans. The Bad Place crew heads back to Bad Place HQ to regroup, leaving Michael to shut down the neighborhood. Michael is relieved to find the humans figured out his plan and are temporarily safe. My guests today are editor Eric Kissack and the actor who plays Michael, Edward Bridge Danson III. Ted and Eric, welcome. Everything is great.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much for being here. Ted, you're joining us via Magic, I think it's called.
Yes, I am. I'm on some sort of a Wi-Fi something.
Emmy nominee Ted Danson. Do you have any questions about the show? I pretty much know everything at this point.
About this episode? I really don't. How do we get so lucky is my question.
That is an authentic and great question. Where do you join us from?
All right, here. I have a question.
Oh, it was a bit. I didn't mean it. All right, what? Oh, no.
I want to hear.
Oh, come on, man.
No, do it.
So we turn Vicky into a cocoon, you right. do, on this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Eric, how long after we shot that and you edited, did you actually get the special effect completely done?
It's a great question. So there's kind of two kinds of visual effects that are done in this show. One is the kind of effect where David Niednagel, who was on a previous episode, mm-hmm. I believe, goes into a dark room, closes the door, and it's really dark. Like, he's actually, like put black paper up on all the windows. Like, you go in there, and you're like, wait, what, is there someone in here? And then your eyes adjust, you know? But he goes in there and does his magic and sort of comes out, like, 12 hours later, sweaty and kind of, like, bleary-eyed, and it's done. And it's amazing.
Just front to back, he's handled it.
He just handled it. Okay. And that happens a lot.
Okay.
Like, a lot of the effects in this, and we can talk about, there's a big effect later that was one of these. The cocoon one was done by an outside vendor, I believe. And so because of that, because the vendors tend to have their own, like, workflow, and there's, like, 10 people that need to touch it and do their thing. Because of that, I believe it probably took like a week.
Oh, okay.
But if David was doing it, it would be like 12 hours.
Is the same true of my cocoon earlier on in the season?
Yeah, so the cocoon is actually an element that was designed by this, I believe it was Digital Domain, which is the house. And anytime we use that element, I believe, and I hope I'm not messing this up, but I believe we have to use the element that they designed and just kind of like place it in the scene in the right spot. But it's that same element that we use over and over again.
Interesting. Ted, you're joining us via the magic of the internet. Why? Where are you? What are you doing?
I'm on holiday. I'm doing nothing. I'm hanging out with my wife, Mary, and kids and grandkids, and just having the best time. I'm on an island off of Massachusetts.
There are only a few. That's great. What is your life like? I'm talking to you about 2 weeks, maybe, after we wrapped season three. And do you decompress? Is it 24/7 massages for you? What's life like?
It's so far, it's been blessedly 24 hours, three grandchildren, three granddaughters. Mm. So it changes the subject so radically because it's not about me, which is, you know, I get a little short of breath, but short of that, it's very normal. Getting up early, going to bed early, taking naps. Yeah, it's kind of boring and wonderful.
That's kind of great. You lead a fairly normal life anyway, though, don't you? I know you go to a normal person's gym in Los Angeles. I know you go to restaurants and things.
I go to Gold's Gym in Venice.
Well, I wasn't going to say it.
Right. Why not? Throw them some biz.
Right. I remember asking you about that and saying, like, don't you get mobbed? Isn't it kind of a scene? And you said that
they're very serious there. And that, you know, as long as you go there to work, they respect you and leave you alone and are just incredibly supportive. And, you know, I love that place. I love it.
I remember shortly after season one aired, my wife and I were downtown one day and we were having lunch in the Grand Central Market. And you came through. We were sitting at probably an 8-stool counter at Bel Campo.
Right.
And you came through with who? David Walton or somebody? Another actor?
Yes. We were both on jury duty.
Right.
We'd come on our break. Yeah.
Wait. Did you actually get chosen for a jury?
No. I think it's actually great that we have to show up. And sometimes, I think my wife Mary was on one once. But by and large, you don't want to necessarily be the face that everybody knows on the jury that sends somebody to jail.
Sure.
So usually they let you go or don't pick you.
I remember you're telling me with regard to this one in particular that you did get advanced to a second round where they sort of started interviewing you. And the first woman to go up, they said, tell us about yourself. And she said her first name and last name. And they were like, whoa. Nobody do that. We don't want to know who you are. And you were like, hey, man, come on. Just amazing.
Pretty funny.
Just amazing. Eric, we've talked a little bit. We've talked with a previous editor on this program and understand a little bit of it. Something that occurred to me on the drive-in just now is that we talked about, I think that you call them buttons or something, like where you find, you know, someone edits down because these are digital cameras that we're rolling on and we often roll forever,
sure,
right? We just
sure.
leave them wide open and reset takes and stuff.
Sure.
So someone has to go and scrub through that and say, this is the end point of this
right.
next take because we're not the clacker that everyone thinks
sure.
about the slate doesn't happen between every take kind of thing.
Right, exactly.
And whose job is that?
So every editor works with an assistant, sometimes more than one assistant, depending on the amount of footage. And generally their job is to sort of go through and organize the footage to sort of say, like, here's where the take starts, here's where it ends, here's if they mess up, there's like a, you can put like a color there, you know, if they do an improv, you mm-hmm. can sort of highlight that. So they do all this work that I can quickly go in and say, like, okay, I see, okay, here's, there's seven takes of this, and then, oh, there looks like there's, like, three versions where they changed it up, you know, and then another version at the end where they just, like, went crazy and did some improv, you mm-hmm. know, that kind of thing. A lot of that work is done beforehand.
And what's your background in that? Did you used to have that job before you became an editor proper?
I got a little bit lucky. I was sort of editing in New York, doing random things, and it was the summer of 2004,
okay.
I want to say, and the Republican National Convention was happening.
Okay.
It was August, and the Daily Show, which at the time was like a phenomenon.
Like King, yeah. It was still John Stewart.
Still John Stewart. They were getting swamped because they were shedding all these, they were doing all these packages down in I think it was Boston or I can't remember where it was, but they were doing all these packages and they were sending them back and they had editors on staff, but they needed an additional editor.
Cool.
And it was August in New York and every editor must have been on vacation or working or something. And I think they must have probably gotten down the list and somehow got to me. And I by no means deserved to be there. I had never done anything of the sort, but literally they called me and they were like, can you come in and work for a couple of weeks?
Wow.
And I was like, yes.
Of course.
But the thing was that at that point, I had only edited on a software program called Final Cut Pro,
sure,
which is sort of still around, but Avid Media Composer is sort of the dominant.
That's the more professional version.
That's what we use now.
Yeah.
And at the time, that's what The Daily Show used. So I didn't know Avid Media Composer. So so I get the call. They're like, can you come in tomorrow? I'm like, great. I run to Barnes & Noble because Barnes & Noble was a thing back then.
Sure. We sold bookstores.
Sure.
We sold books in stores.
Yeah. And I bought like The Idiot's Guide to Avid. And I stayed up all night reading it. And I show up at The Daily Show and I have the book in my bag. And I'm pretty well versed, but you know, I get there and you know, Jon Stewart is like waiting. He's like, "Hi, great to meet you." And I'm like, "What's happening?" And at the time, Stephen Colbert was there,
sure,
and he was like, "Hey, man, how's it going?" And Rob Corddry was there. Hey, and Ed Helms was there, and I was like, thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
That's some pressure, yeah.
But I was also super nervous because I didn't really know what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so I sat down to sort of edit this. It was this Ed Helms piece, and I was working on it. I was doing a good job, but every now and then they would ask me to do something, and I didn't know how to do it because I didn't know the software very well. So I would say, sure, no problem. I'm just going to run to the bathroom real quick. And I would take my backpack with me into the bathroom.
Hilarious.
Flip to the page, find the answer, and go back in and do it. And this happened like three or four times. And by like the fourth time, Stephen Colbert turned to me and was like, are you okay, man?
Yeah.
Are you feeling okay?
Right.
And I'm like, it must have been something I ate. I don't know. I'm sorry. And it was probably the most stressful day of my life, but I got through it and, you know, wound up being there for like, I think like 4 or 5 weeks.
I think what you're describing is a leap to faith where you said, I don't know it yet, but I'll get there.
That's a great transition.
Fake it till you make it.
Exactly.
Ted, we open on this episode. I guess we've come off the previous episode where things are going great for Michael. And he goes back to his office. And shockingly, Sean is there. Unexpected. We haven't seen Sean in a little bit. And at the beginning of this episode, it's sort of teased that I'm going to come and punish you or that I'm onto it. And instead, I'm really, really happy with what's going on. I've bought in. I still think that this is version two, even though you've rebooted these humans 800 times. No question. That's just a fact.
I was about to say that was really good. And you know this show really well, and you're so good at this. But please continue.
So when you're at Gold's Gym in Venice...
No.
Wait, actually, I mean, this is actually something that I've been wondering about you, Mark,
uh-oh,
which is, so I've been listening to episodes since they started, and you sort of seem like a natural at this, and I guess I'm sort of just wondering, like, what is your background in podcasting, interviewing, you know, or are you just a sort of a naturally voluble individual?
As a gift at natural everything. I'll do this quickly. I have been on lots of podcasts. I've been the victim of many bad panels at Comic-Cons and things. And I do have some experience in it, but though it was years and years ago, I worked for a National Public Radio affiliate in West Michigan, WGVU AM and FM back in the day. And so I was a producer. I was, you know, 25 or something. And on a Friday, they fired the host and said, on Monday, you're the host. And so that's how that started. And I grew up on NPR. I'm definitely a child of National Public Radio. So that the cadence, the music, the tone of it is definitely in my bones.
And is your interview style based on any particular inspiration?
I like to think that Terry Gross got her stuff from me.
I think it's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question,
no,
Mark?
Oh, no. Yes. I was so close to talking about the episode.
How did you learn how to speak so fast?
So fast?
Yes, so fast.
I don't know.
You speak very quickly.
Are you referring to like in performance, like on camera stuff or in life?
Right now.
Oh, okay.
I keep pausing you and replaying it so I can understand what you're saying, but please go on.
I honestly think that is the factor of being the youngest of three children and having to snipe, like having to, like, if I'm going to say it, it's got to get in there. before I get mown over kind of thing. My two older siblings are not monsters by any means, but I think that that's a factor of it to be like, I also have something to say.
Okay. Can I ask one more question before I hand this back to you?
Sure. And then we'll throw to a break and then we'll be done.
Okay. So Eric.
Yes.
So kind of especially in this part, but because it's Michael is so kind of in the second season, especially all over the map as far as energy and believability and, you know, his range of emotions go all over the place. So I'd say 60, 70% of the time when I do a take, it's kind of pushed and it's not quite there, but I'm trying to get it there. And then if we're lucky, I land one out of seven takes. Can you see that when you are editing? What I mean is sometimes all the words will be right and the camera's right, but the performance is just a little bit behind or not quite there. Or and then the actor lands one and that's the one you pick. And when I watch, it feels like you invariably do. But what's that like for you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you're way too modest. I mean, I'd say you nail it 6 out of 7 times. but you know, I mean, I think there's an experience watching the footage of knowing exactly what I'm looking for. You know, I'm looking for the person to be this level of malevolent and, you know, this level of nervous and this level of energy. And I have this, like, ideal version of the line in my mind. And Mike and I do this a lot in the edit room where we'll sort of stop and we'll say, you know, when Mike will say, you know, when I wrote the line or when someone wrote the line, you know, it was meant to be like this, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll be like, right, exactly. That's how you would do it. And then we watch the takes and we're like, okay, that one is like 80% there. Okay. That one's 90%. Oh, there it is. We found it. Or sometimes it'll be, oh, okay, the first half of that was perfect. But if we take the first half and add it to the second half of take 8, then we've got the perfect combination, you know. So
rhythmically, musically.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And then, you know, of course, Mike is always the one who ultimately is going to be like, no, he should be 10% more malevolent here, you know. So I sort of had this idea in my head of what it should sound like, and then he's always sort of double-checking that we're in the right emotional space.
But then on top of that, there are times where everything may be right, except the actor wasn't 100% in his body, if that makes sense. Do you see that as well?
Yes, definitely. And then, you know, like there are always occasions where, you know, we, in order to, like, the sound is perfect, but yeah, like, there's something, it looks like maybe there's a physical uncomfortability or something, and sometimes we'll have to, you know, cut away to a reaction shot. But, you know, the beauty of this show is that everyone is interesting to cut to.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Probably more so than other shows.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, you can always cut to Kristen Bell, you know, to cover something up. And again, I want to stress that This is rarely an issue with you, Ted. But
did you say if she's not texting? Is that what you said?
Yes.
or rolling bubblegum around on her tongue?
She always has gum in her mouth.
Have we talked about this on the show?
No.
No.
Kristen Bell.
She acts with a full wad of gum in her mouth.
Kristen Bell, in every single scene, in every single second of the show, has a piece of gum in her mouth.
It made a gag reel, I think a season 2 gag reel, which was just released, where she's doing a take and she pulls something out of her mouth to give to Michael and her gum goes with it. and you can hear Ted go, were you chewing gum? And she goes, I always have gum in my mouth.
Yeah.
Apparently that's fact.
That's a thing. Yeah. Like, and it's not like a secret. Like it's like, that's her thing, you know, and it's amazing. And you can never tell. And I can never tell.
Mm-mm. I would choke in the first 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I can't walk and do that at the same time. So I don't know how she does it.
So to answer your question, Ted, yes, we are always aware of those kind of things and look for those kind of things. And if we, you know, need to do some sort of trickery to sort of cut around it, we can. I mean, a lot of the time what we do in this show is split screens. So say the performance of one actor is perfect on the left side of the frame, but not great on, you know, the other actor on the right side of the frame is not great. We'll take a different take. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We do this all the time, like on every episode.
It's called a map or something.
It's called a mat.
M-A-T-T-E.
Mat, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll literally combine takes. And sometimes.
You mean if we're in a 2-shot?
Yes.
One of the actors.
You can zip it down the middle.
You can zip it down the middle. And
holy cow.
Yeah. And
nothing is real.
Nothing's real. And even if the camera is moving, that used to be a problem. Like when I first started editing, it'd be like, oh, the camera's moving, we can't do a split screen.
Right.
But now they have these tools that you can just, once one button, you track it, and it
I've
just
seen
matches.
All the little arrows, right?
Wow.
Yeah, all the little arrows, and everything just matches up perfectly, and it looks like it was just one take.
I've been working far too hard. I should give you one good one.
Exactly.
And then phone it in.
Yeah, just be on your phone the whole
Holy
time.
Holy cow. I had no idea that was the case.
That is amazing. I didn't know that either. Wow.
Remind me of the process. Oh, go ahead.
It takes a community to make one actor's performance. amazing.
I mean, I will say, you know, rarely is it like, oh, this performance is bad, we have to fix it, or we have to split screen or something like that. The number one thing that happens is this show, I'd say the average script on this show is 29 or 30 pages,
mm-hmm.
okay, which translate roughly into 29 or 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the rule of thumb. It's usually true. That's too long.
Yeah. It should be 21 and a half.
We air the show at 21 and a half. And so when I cut the show together and Mike and I watched the first version of it, it is 7.5, 8, 9 minutes too long.
Yeah.
So the biggest challenge that we have is, and by the way, that's intentional, because the idea is you write, you know, 30 minutes worth of funny jokes, and then you cut away all the B+, A- jokes, and you're just left with the A jokes.
Right.
But the problem is you never know ahead of time which ones are going to be the A jokes when you're writing, you know, because you never know what Ted is going to bring to it, or Kristen's going to bring to it, or Mark's going to bring to it.
Mark brings nothing.
Who is the last one?
Some guy. So the biggest challenge editorially is getting from that 30 to that 21, 30. And a lot of what we have to do is this trickery, you know, where we need to take out every breath between words. We need to, you know, any pause, we cut it in half, that kind of thing. So a lot of this kind of like the split screens and that kind of thing, it's purely because of timing.
That's amazing to me. Ted, you in every episode, I suppose for this entire television program, but especially in this one, had to play, you know, diverse, divergent intentions. I'm thinking of the scene early on when we're in your office and I invite the humans in and we sit them down and you say, surprise, you're in the bad place. And they don't know if you're on their side at this point. So they're like, wait, is this real? Why are you? And they're asking Michael, you know, outside of Sean. Sean hasn't met them yet that he knows of in this current reboot. But you have to play this really intricate and delicate balance of trying to seem mean enough in front of Sean, but also trying to send them coded things. You know, this is the beginning. It manifests later in the roast. But talk a little bit about what it's like to play those potentially fraught intentions.
I don't know if I 100% agree. Because I think that Mike, the tone that he wanted was that the audience should believe.
Oh, okay.
Eric, you may have been part of a tone meeting or something, but
sure.
I think I remember that he wanted the audience to believe, you know, the possibility that I had flipped. And when you gave me that award, you gave Michael that
the senior staff
pin and everything, that was so excited, you know, that receiving that I think it kind of set up the possibility that he had flipped, and then the roast made it feel like anyway, he didn't want the audience to go, oh. So it was easy. I just played
me
as if I were the demon bad guy, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, the intention at the end of, I believe it's Act 2, where the roast it completes, was to have the audience believe, oh, no, he's flipped.
Right.
He's back in, he's comfortable. He's been a demon for thousands of years.
Right.
Obviously, he would go back to being a demon when he had a good reason to.
It's not a giant leap to make to believe that, oh, that's right, like this, there was this quick 802 blips, but yes, he's back to doing what he does.
That said, the challenge in this episode was always that the audience, as an audience member myself who watches the show and loves the show, you want Ted Danson to be the good guy so bad that it was, we were sort of like, no one's really going to believe that he flipped. But I think we got to a good middle point.
Oh, you buy it for sure. You buy it for sure. I'm thinking back to that office scene too, Ted, and how fun it was throughout this episode to watch Darcy play Janet drunk with the Magganins handcuffs.
She was really good in that. That was great. That was fun.
Some of it's on the page, but the rest of it is really her.
Yes, I agree. That was very funny. I hadn't seen that. I was just watching it a minute ago. It's very funny.
Have you legitimately not watched the episode until this?
For some reason, this one. Yeah, I don't know why.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You don't. You don't. It's not destination television for you Thursday nights, NBC.
When possible.
Okay.
But then there'll be kids or something come up. You know.
Oh sure.
I'd say there are about 50 episodes of Cheers that I've never seen because it was putting kids to bedtime. You know, when that was on. So. Anyway, I always have a bit of a struggle watching anything that I'm in.
Is that true?
Yeah. So anyway, it takes me a couple of viewings to finally go, oh, this is good.
Well, let's take a moment and remind you of something that happened in this episode. Full episodes are available on NBC.com or the NBC app. Let's listen to a clip.
This is a PR disaster. We have to keep it all under wraps. Get her on the train. And if anyone else says a single word of what happened here to anyone, you will be in a cocoon just like Vicky, and it is gooey in there.
How do we get the humans back from Mindy's?
They bought themselves some time, but we'll get them. I'll start the extradition papers. You stay here. I want every trace of this neighborhood erased.
Idea. That was so scary so many different times. I hated that.
You guys! I was so scared for you!
We told you he was on our side.
You're my friends, and I wanted to save you!
It's okay, bud.
This is the best summer ever, you guys.
Oh.
That, for me, is a moment just as good and akin to your evil laugh in episode 113. That is such a wonderful moment, Ted Danson.
Thank you. Thank you. Here's a question from, you know, Eric. Now, that particular moment, I know for a fact there must have been a crap load of whoops, a little over the top, or ooh, that's not too good, you know, and to land on the one that kind of hits is... I really appreciate. Thank you. You do save actors. You know, you do take the best of what people give, and it's that's a real talent to me. Really good editing. So
thank you.
Thank you.
I will treasure that comment always. I am actually owed more than you know for that moment, and I will tell you why very briefly.
Please.
Which is,
we should do like a podcast about it.
We should.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are three times over. Three seasons of this show that I've asked for something to be reshot.
Really?
Yeah. Usually you don't have to worry about that because usually the everyone is so good and everyone gets nails everything. You don't have to worry. You know?
Yeah.
Once they missed an insert, it was an easy thing.
Okay.
You know, just picked it up. It was fine. Once there was a miscommunication between Mike and the director, the staging was changed in a way that I can't talk about yet because
sure.
It's an upcoming episode. But the staging was changed in a way that made it not work.
Okay,
you can have me back and we can talk about that.
Guaranteed.
The third was that moment, and here's why: when they first shot that, it was kind of a thrown away moment. It was like there's a moment of tension in the script. It was like there's a moment of tension. We don't quite know what's going to happen. Ted
is Michael good? Is Michael bad?
Is Michael good? Is Michael bad? Michael looks mean, and then he says, you know, you guys, and it's clear that he's on their side. And it was sort of shot as a throwaway moment. The camera was sort of sitting there. You know, it was kind of like a medium wide shot.
Hmm.
And I loved so much what Ted was doing in that moment. I just thought it was like making me so giddy with joy. That I called up Morgan Sackett, mm-hmm. The producer of the show, and I said, this is such an amazing moment. You need to reshoot it and put a camera move on it so that the camera pushes in and highlights his
almost
face.
Almost like the 113 moment, right?
Yes, yes, because it's so great and it'll be something that people remember, and right now it's not being treated with the weight that it deserves.
Yeah.
So they agreed and they did it.
That's amazing because that obviously involves time and money,
yeah.
Things that television networks and studios are concerned about. Did you use the same sound effect as episode 113? That
yes.
That sort of orchestral, like
yeah, yeah. We've used that two or three times now in the show. It's sort of our go-to of like, you think something really bad is going to happen.
Yeah,
you know.
What did the script say? Do you remember, Ted? What was the stage direction of like? The camera crashes in, or I guess it wouldn't have said that if we were in a static medium wide.
There was a, in my acting background, teaching, schooling, you kind of crossed out all the stage directions.
Oh.
It's kind of an arrogant methody acting way of trying not to limit your imagination by reading stage directions. So to this day, I really kind of barely glimpse at them.
That's amazing.
But I do remember going to, I always come from scarcity, like there's no way I'll be able to do this justice. So I remember talking, I can't remember to which writer or Mike. I don't really have to be super upset here, do I?
That's the kind of thing you might say to a director?
Yes. Yeah. And the answer was, yes, yes, you do. You need to be super upset.
That's amazing.
It was great. But it's one of those things, too. At first you think, oh, the emotion is scary. Will I be able to get the emotion? And then you slowly work your way through that. And then you get to, you just discover, really, if you give the words their full import and just say the words, it will lead you someplace, you know, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you guys.
That's all it is. But I mean, what a wonderful, you know, absolutely now certain, I'm on your side kind of thing.
I was about to say, it's sort of a tipping point for the show. Because mm-hmm. at that point forward, Mike is just on the team so hard.
Yeah.
Basically human.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're on Team Cockroach after that. It's such a lovely moment, Ted. And I thank you.
You're very kind. But as you can tell, it was a village that made that moment.
There's a theme running through this episode that I suppose if you don't read stage directions, maybe you're not playing the theme, but I would guess it comes into the edit. And we hear several times, beginning with you and me, Ted, I offer you that senior staff pin and say, it's everything you've ever wanted. And that is the authenticity for Michael of like, it is, you can feel it. Like, holy cow, this is everything I've ever wanted. And then at the bottom of the episode two, Tahani says, like, all the demons are on a train leaving here. We're alone. We've done it. It says everything we've ever wanted. Does Eric, does that sort of thing work its way into the edit as bookends or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of that stuff is stuff that Mike and I talk a lot about in the edit room, you know, of it's interesting that so I worked on season one and I was not one of the people who knew about the twist.
Oh, wow.
So I would constantly be like, well, why don't we cut this? You know, we're still like 20 seconds over. You know, we don't need this little moment, this little aside. And Mike's like, no, we need it.
Wow.
And I'd be like, why? And he'd be like, just trust me, we need it.
He asked you to take a leap to faith.
He did. And I actually got really frustrated.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Did any editors know?
No.
Okay.
Well, so about halfway through editing the first season, he told the two editors.
Okay.
And so then it was sort of like, oh, well, sure. Okay, now I get it. But yeah, it was because getting to that 21:30, it is this frustrating experience.
Well, I can't imagine.
Where you're just like, we're 10 seconds away. We're 5 seconds away. Just, how about this line? Can't we just cut this line, please? You know? And so, yeah, that was...
And there are certain chess piece nugget breadcrumbs that he needed in there.
Exactly. But anyway, but now that everything's on the table, yeah, we talk a lot about those little bookends. Mike particularly loves those lines that are sort of set in one context and then set in another context. Mm-hmm. They actually come up over and over again, and they're lovely. They make me very happy.
In this episode, I don't think it's spoken a third time, but it ends with Mindy St. Clair getting everything she ever wanted, a guy, or mostly a guy, and a duffel bag of cocaine.
Yeah.
Ted, talk a little bit about Jason Mantzoukas, who plays Derek. It's my understanding that his first day on set, right before you rolled, I think it was Dean Holland directing the first time that we met Derek. And I feel like Dean said to Jason, so we're going to do this, we're going to do this. Also, go ahead and do whatever you want. And Jason said that you were like, wait a second, what? Do you remember meeting him?
Oh, I think, yes, I do. But I think I was trying to make him laugh.
Okay.
I definitely knew how outrageously funny he is.
Oh, my goodness.
He is one of those just naturally outrageously charismatic and funny people. You just want to start laughing immediately.
He's one of those people.
I love watching him work. It's like he's so brave. It's like I want to take brave lessons from him. He's just outrageous.
He is fearless. He is. Yeah. He comes from the UCB. He comes from Upright Citizens Brigade and is very improvisational and super playful. He like I think a lot of improvisers, wants to take the scene right to the edge of ruining it and then 20% beyond and then maybe come back.
Right.
That's got to be tough in an edit when you've got a billion alts, right?
Yeah, well, so I did two movies with Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, sure.
I cut Bruno and The Dictator.
Hey, cool.
So I'm used to working with improv, mm-hmm. and in particular, I'm used to working with Jason Mantzoukas, who starred opposite Sacha Baron Cohen in The Dictator. And I've seen Sacha be in situations that, like, no mortal human should ever remain serious in, you know, just like crazy, crazy situations, but he never, ever breaks, except when he's with Jason Mantzoukas.
Is that right?
Yeah, who can basically make anyone laugh. And there are these scenes where it's just the two of them going on and just like trying to like one-up one another in, you know, improv comedy. And it's like, I mean, we had versions of scenes that ended up being a minute and a half that the first cut of was 30 minutes long, and you could happily watch the entire thing and just not get bored because it was just like two geniuses working at the top of their game. It was amazing.
Jason Mantzoukas is Sacha Baron Cohen's kryptonite. I love it.
He kind of is, yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. Ted, talk about the roast. We shot what was, in fact, a big panel, a big dais with you at a podium and, I don't know, 80 background actors in Town Square. And I feel like there, you know, you had cue cards and stuff and it felt like the Friars Club. Is it weird to do that in front of all those background actors?
No, you know, that was fun. That was one of those kind of carte blanche moments where you didn't even really have to worry about the lines because I was holding cue cards like you would in a roast in my hand, and there were cue cards out, or teleprompters out there, so there was no worry about words, and it was just how to be the most obnoxious. And just a second ago I was watching what you guys did in editing or special effects, that when the other characters are recounting what Michael says during the roast in the form of clues, mm-hmm. how you did that kind of blue light around my character and everyone else was kind of in black and white. That's spectacular. That was really cool.
Why is that?
To
denote a memory?
Yeah, it was. The idea was to create a kind of hyper real version of what had happened, you know, because the whole idea of that speech was that it was a roast that's supposed to make them feel awful about themselves, but actually there were clues in the roast.
Right.
And so when going back and thinking about the clues, we were like, well, what does it look like when you sort of like focus on a memory and try to pull something out of that memory? And it was just literally us talking about, you know, what would that look like and trying to
highlight
close
it.
Your eyes and then see it. And yeah, exactly.
Wow. That's so interesting. The roast is an essential ingredient in this episode because so much of what you're saying is legitimately mean-spirited and super personal. You know, there's no wink or nod to, like, I'm going light on you or I'm giving you four clues of 1,200 that you'll pick up upon. To say that you love Chidi and Chidi doesn't love you back, or I forgot Jason's, but I'm super dumb.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Promotional consideration is furnished by the following totally real advertiser.
Who says a party needs more than one person? Lonely Gal Margarita Mix for one. The only friend you need is booze. Available at any sad place where sad people go.
Just as a brief aside, I don't know where this goes into this episode of the podcast, but I want to make sure people know that there's an Easter egg in the episode. So there's David Niednagel, our VFX supervisor, is constantly trying to sneak in Easter eggs.
Wow.
Because he just, that's what he does, loves to do, basically. And there is an episode, I believe it's, oh, okay, it's 203. It's 203. Okay, sorry. So it's the episode where they go to Mean State Clara's house and they realize they've been there many times before.
Yes.
And they've kept a log of all of their tries. And one of the plans to upend Michael is catch that magic panda, use her power. And Eleanor goes, oh, that was Jason's.
Obviously a Jason.
Obviously a Jason one.
Yeah.
And so David Niengal, who has like a steel trap brain, was just like, oh, well, I definitely need to put a magic panda in one of the episodes. And so there is a shot in this episode where the camera's pulling back and there's sort of a four-headed bear, a dragon
bear.
Something
flies through.
Flying through.
Yeah.
Which is also a reference to another episode. We mentioned a four-headed flying bear. But in the background of that shot, teleporting around the scene is a magic panda. All the way in the back. You have to look for it. It's not very obvious.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's...
Is it the night scene? It's the night scene. Oh, great.
And it's jumping around, and it's eating, like, a bamboo, and it's, like, causing destruction. Like, it's, like, knocking over, like, planters and that kind of thing. It's genius. And no one will ever see it if they're not looking for it, but I hope you all go back and look at it.
But you know what? I mean, what you're just describing is why 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds will come up to me and say that they watch, you know, each episode two or three times, and they're, you know, they're totally hooked. Because it has so many delicious, thoughtful, well-planned-out things, you
yes.
know,
awesome.
That, like you just described. I mean, it's such a joy to work with so many creative people who are just, it's like Mike unleashed, you know, all of us and go be your most creative self. and here's the result. I mean, it's pretty magical.
It is magical. And it also feels like, as Dean Holland says in an episode of this podcast, everyone working on this show just wants it to be good.
Yeah.
There's no ego. There's no bravado. There's no defensiveness. Anytime I've ever seen a director or Mike go to a department and say, super giant change of plans, we have to do this. Everybody goes, okay. Nobody goes, no, I just spent 2 weeks, you know. I've never seen that once.
And that is a tone set at the top. I mean, this is not rocket science,
yep.
but,
right.
you know, I mean, I remember listening to an episode where you did with Josh and Dylan.
Yeah.
And they talked about how...
Daddy.
They talked about Daddy, but they also talked about how there were certain jokes that would get cut out of a script, and in other shows, it would get put into, like, the scrap bag or something like mm-hmm. that, or the scrap peep. And on this show, it's the candy bag.
Candy bag.
And that's intentional.
Yeah.
That's intentional. Someone thought, you know what, it'll... feel nice,
yeah.
you know, if it goes into a candy bag instead of a scrap heap.
The same thing as being said.
One of the writers will feel like they didn't waste an hour of their life thinking of that line.
Yeah, people feel respected. I mean, look, all anyone wants in the world is to feel respected, right?
Amen. Yeah.
and I think Mike does such a good job of setting that tone of, like, we're all going to work hard, we're all going to yeah. bring our A game. And no matter what, we're all going to be respected. And so you feel free to come up with some crazy idea like, hey, let's put a magic panda in the background that jumps around because you know you're not going to be like shot down with a, oh, that's such a stupid idea, you know?
The same thing.
Hey,
oh, go for it.
You know, Eric.
Yeah.
On behalf of Mark, myself, and all of the actors, we are so lucky to have you. We really are. It's amazing. What a good job you do and hearing you talk about it. It's really exciting.
I've just passed out.
Eric is dead.
I'm gone.
Long live Eric. no, the same
thank
thing
you,
is
Ted.
True. You know, I echo what Ted is saying. That is, you save us. I think we would lose our minds on set if we thought, like, that was it. Moving on. That was our last shot at it. And to know that you are going to assemble and now armed with the new knowledge of split screens.
Split screens. And we haven't even talked about ADR. I don't know if you talked about ADR at all.
We haven't. ADR is what? Automatic dialogue replacement.
Exactly.
And it's when sometimes actors are asked to come back in later to sweeten a line where a helicopter went over or someone sneezed in the background or to even sort of late rewrite the script, right?
Yeah. I mean, so the number one time we use it again is when we're trying to condense things. So we're like, oh, okay, we need to remove 20 seconds from the scene. We'll cut this line and this line and this line. Now we need a way to combine these two parts of the scene that were never designed to combine. So sometimes it's as easy as having Ted or Mark come in and say, and
right,
yeah. and literally the word "and" will bridge the two parts of the scene.
Right,
or sometimes it's like, okay, well, the scene had five lines, and line one was a little bit angry, and line five was very angry. But now we're going from line one to line five, so we need to get line one very angry.
Yes.
So you don't go from little angry to very angry, and it sounds crazy. So you re-record the line, not change the timing, not change the words or anything like that, but just change your tone
right.
so that it fits in with what we've done.
I also recognize this show is fairly seamless, but I, just because I do this for a living, know that when they've been shooting on the beach to reboot Janet it and stuff, and you see everyone's hair moving. It's like, this has to be ADR because there's no way that they got that clean because the mics are going to sound like...
Yeah, the beaches were the one scenes that we basically had to replace every piece
almost
of...
Almost
everything, yeah.
I'm thinking of one other Easter egg. Your name is used later in an episode. You obviously know that. Did you edit that episode?
I did edit that episode,
okay.
Yes.
Should we... Let's let people find it themselves.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I'll just say the way it came up was we had another name in there, and that name didn't clear.
Oh, interesting.
So clearing's a thing. Basically, when you throw a real person's name into a show, the NBC legal department has to make sure that that name is not... It's funny. It can be someone famous, because I think that's fair use, but it can't be like someone who lives in Burbank, you know, because then it's like...
Just a normal person.
Just normal. It can't just be a normal person. And so it's so random. Like sometimes, like, you know, Joe Smith comes back and it's like, yeah, that's fine. And it's like, really?
Right.
You know, but this particular name didn't come back. And so we were like, well, we got to replace it. And I just was like, could it be my name?
So it's your last name. And listeners to this podcast and viewers to The Good Place, go looking.
And if they ever let you go, Eric, just sue their
asshole
for that use of your name.
That's the plan B.
Eric Kisak, what's good?
There is a email newsletter called Future Crunch.
Oh.
And it's fantastic. Everyone should subscribe. It's free, although you can donate some money to them if you want to help them out. It comes out about once every 2 or 3 weeks. It's a little random, but basically it is a list of everything good that is happening in the world. So it's literally links to articles about the, you know, installation of a new solar grid in India, mm-hmm. or the eradication of malaria in this sub-Saharan African country.
Wow.
And it's such a joy to get because there's a lot of not so great things happening in the world. And I feel like a lot of times we get overwhelmed. We sort of feel like, oh man, like everything's awful and there's no point in feeling, you know, like there's something to empower us. And then you get this newsletter and there's like 30 things in each newsletter that are just good things that are happening around the world. And you're just like, wow, that's great. And so it feels good. So
Future Crunch.
Future Crunch will have to do that. And then this is sort of random, but I love music. And I happen to, there's an album that just came out by a woman named Mitski, M-I-T-S-K-I, called Be the Cowboy,
okay.
I believe it's called. It might be called Be Your Cowboy. But I just been listening to it all morning. And it's one of those albums where you listen to and every song that comes on, you get goosebumps because you're like, this, oh my God, this song is so good. Oh my God, this song is so good. And everyone should listen to it.
Teddy.
Mm.
What's good?
Hearing Little Feet at 5:30 in the morning come pattering across the living room, slam open your door, and leap into your bed. And all of a sudden, you got three little grandkids in bed as you're waking up. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty great.
Watching butterflies out the window while talking to you, Mark, that's pretty good. My life is, I have to say, I liked Eric's answer better.
I'm liking your answer better.
But I'm really, life feels like dessert right now. And my biggest job is just to keep saying thank you, thank you, thank you, because it's pretty amazing. And not to just bring this back to the show, but I am so proud to be part of a show that's about decency, you know, that people's actions matter, that there are ripples effects, and that what you do goes out into the world and creates a certain amount of good or a certain amount of bad. I love that we're doing that, and we're doing it with a sense of humor and with visual magic. I just am so proud at, you know, age 70 to be part of a show that's putting this out into the world.
Eric Kisak and Emmy nominee Ted Danson, thank you for being with us.
What are you going to say if I don't win an Emmy? That's going to be Emmy loser for the next podcast, right?
Emmy aware actor, Ted Danson. This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Go do something good. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
You can hear us whispering.
Hi, Mary.
While you're talking?
Just once, just that time.
How are you?
I wasn't in the room till just this second. I promise. on my honor. I came in to tell him that our friends are coming over at 4:30.
Our friends are coming over.
That's so great.
I'm asking you if you want a cup of tea.
I would love a cup of tea. Mark, what, Eric, cup of tea?
Oh, please, you guys like a cup? What are we talking about? Rooibos? What are we doing?
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. And now to deliver our credit sequence is Bad Janet. Take it away, Bad Janet.
Whatever. If you enjoyed this podcast, which, like, how is that even possible? Please subscribe. It's available on all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts. I don't even know. Or if you don't want to subscribe, you can also just listen to your mom's butt, you fat dink. You burnt.
Why don't I handle the credits? The podcast is hosted by Mark Evan Jackson, produced by Grant Rutter.
Who?
It's written by Lizzie Pace, and the music is composed by David Schwartz.
David Schwartz. See you next time, nerds.